Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guests this week, Shane Joseph and Susan Statham. Each week at this time, we visit with local authors and people who are connected with the writing world. Many of our guests, as is the case this week, are involved in more than one artistic field. Shane Joseph is both a writer and a publisher at Blue Denim Press, and Susan Statham is a well-known artist and a novelist. Today, we are going to talk to them a little about a joint project that they have on hand, as well as finding out a little bit more about Blue Denim Press. So, welcome, Shane and Susan.
Thank you for having us on the show.
Thank you.
Shane Joseph is the author of four novels and at present has several more in the works. He is an award-winning short story writer and has published two collections of his short stories. He also produces works of nonfiction, including memoir, book reviews, and essays, which have been published in anthologies and journals all over the world. In 2010, he and his wife, Sarah Jacobs, set up Blue Denim Press right here in Coburg, and they are now building a substantial list of published works. Susan Statham is a portrait painter with a long list of commissions behind her. She also teaches painting and used her artistic background in her mystery novel, The Painter's Craft. She is now at work on the second of a planned series. So let's begin with you, Shane. Can you tell us a little about this latest project and why it brought you and Susan together to complete it?
Yes, well, I wrote this book about 8 years ago, based on a trip I took to Peru, and specifically to Machu Picchu, in 2002. I shelved the book because I didn't think its time had come. And then, a couple of years ago, I resurrected the project, and I realized that I had been writing about a modern-day novel about Peru and Canada, and it needed to have some context with its historic origins, which go back to the time of Pizarro's conquest of Peru. And so I wrote the historical section last year, and fuse the two pieces together to make it a more comprehensive novel. Having done that, I realized that the historical section would probably look nicer if it had some illustrations to sort of convey the period. And that's when I spoke to Susan, who's, as you know, a very good painter and writer herself. And so we decided to take the 8 sections of the historical story, and set them up with an illustration that starts those particular chapters. And so that's how this project came about. And now we have completed the work, and the book will be out in the fall of this year.
Now, in the 19th century, illustrations were very common in the books by the great Victorian authors like Charles Dickens. Bowes's pictures are probably remembered as clearly as Dickens's descriptions, but illustrations have fallen out of fashion, so it's kind of unusual that you would think to have illustrations at all. So why do you think they are becoming more popular again?
Well, I have to say that illustrations are becoming popular because of the TV and film culture that we're living in today. Graphic novels, as we used to call them, comic books, are now very popular. I've been asked to write them, and I have been furiously resisting them because I'm a novelist, and I like to have the word on the page conjure up the images for the reader. I don't want to spoon-feed them with pictures. But one has to also bow to popular opinions and popular tastes, and the illustration is definitely on its way back. We decided not to make this a graphic novel, so the illustrations that we have in this book are there just to set the scene. They're at the start of each of those 8 historic chapters, and they just set a scene and paint a picture of what things could have been like, and then, of course, you get into the words, and the words convey the story. So, yes, I grant that illustrations are coming back, but I don't want to overuse them and make them the focus of the book. The book is still a novel.
And I guess that's where you come in, Susan, because you need to decide as an illustrator where your illustrations will be best served in a book. So what attracted you to this project?
Well, first of all, I had to read the book. And in reading it, I could see how a small illustration at the beginning of each of the novel, the book within the book, how that would immediately alert the reader and also provide extra information. A picture's worth a thousand words and all that. And I recall the images that were in the Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, those sorts of, you know, not really elaborate, but finely done, nevertheless.
Yeah. I think that's a
and I got a chance to draw.
I think that's a key thing you just said there, that add extra information. I think if illustrations only tell you what the words have already told you, that's when they become unnecessary. But I like the idea of learning something extra about the story from the illustrations.
And there's an historian named Carlyle, and he felt that a portrait would tell him almost everything he needed to know about an historical figure. And of course, in The Shadow of the Conquistador, we're talking about these historical figures like Francisco Pizarro. And as I read it, I thought, I wonder what he looked like. So immediately I had to find out.
So the illustrations then of Pizarro himself are historically accurate. Like,
yes.
You had to go and research all that?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Each image is researched and does add to what you're reading.
Oh, sounds really interesting. But maybe we should hear a little bit from this new project. Shane, would you like to read something for us?
Sure. Since we'll be talking about the historical section, I'll read from the historical section first. As Susan mentioned, it's a book within a book. We have a modern story, and then embedded in that is the old story. So this is an extract from the old story, the story of Pizarro himself, his first encounter with the Inca. Francisco Pizarro was tired from days of marching over the Cordillera before arriving in the lush valley. Like in Tumbes, the natives had obligingly vanished from their city. Caxamalca giving his paltry band of 177 men the run of the place. He stood in the Plaza de Armas beside his lieutenant, De Soto, and his brother, Hernando, squinting against the occasional glint from the chain mail of his men who were hiding strategically around the plaza and waiting for him to drop his handkerchief. Pathetically outnumbered, surprise was their only advantage, and guns. They had attended mass that morning, and the men had been given an extra large breakfast. Now they longed to kill. And now Atahualpa, king of the Inca, and his entourage were outside the gates of Caxamalca, invited to dinner by the Spaniards. The Inca were colorful in tunics of white and red. The vanguard swept the path in front of their ruler and his party with large tree branches. Three battalions followed from among the tens of thousands of troops encamped outside the city, littering the plain. They stood tall, signifying noble birth, and their breastplates and helmets glinted, casting Francisco's troops' telltale signs into shadow. There were 5,000, perhaps 6,000 Inca in the square as the sun began to go over the city's ramparts. The press of humanity parted, and Atahualpa appeared on a throne borne upon a litter with the magnificent plumes of his diadem fanning the air around him. His haughty manner demanded privilege and obeisance as his birthright. His men bowed their heads in his presence, and he squinted quizzically at these white men who merely stared him down. Fray Vicente, who had conducted mass that morning, stepped between the Inca and the Spaniards, and with raised cross in one hand and a Bible in the other, said, "It is God's will that you be the friend of our commander." Atahualpa shot back through his interpreter, "Your men have mistreated us. You have stolen from our storehouses." Vicente protested at this affront, stamping his foot in the dusty square, going so far as to say, "You will submit to the authority of the King of Spain, become a Christian, and abandon your idolatry of the sun that sinks each day, unlike our God in heaven." "I will never be a Christian," was the translated reply. "Your master may be my friend, and we accept his offer of hospitality, but I will never give up my God." Atahualpa inclined his head towards the setting sun. Francisco seized his opportunity, while the priest and king were locked in ideological debate. Pulling his tunic around him and drawing his sword, he ran across the square, waving his handkerchief. Arriving at the Inca's litter, he pulled the startled king off his perch and yelled, "Santiago!" the code for shoot at will. The plaza exploded in gunfire, coming from all directions, picking off the Inca like dazed ducks. Pausing to reload was the only determinant of how many died, how fast. All the while, Francisco held on to his prize hostage, who was not as strong as his royal bluster had projected. The Spanish cavalry emerged in the wake of their guns, slashing left and right, yelling, spilling blood that flew across the square as heads parted bodies and rolled in the dust. The trapped Inca tried to retreat to the gate, which had closed behind them. The surprise was total. The nobles in Atahualpa's entourage made one brave attempt to surround their leader and fend off the Spaniards, but they too were mowed down relentlessly by the pressing cavalry. The square fell quiet as the life of the Inca was taken out of it. The groans of the dying were relentlessly extinguished by slashing, sabers, or a fired gun, or a horse hoof grinding down on bone. Atahualpa was led away into captivity, in shock, his feathers drooping and trailing behind him like broken wings. His troops outside the walls began retreating in disarray. "Remember," a triumphant Francisco called after him, "supper is at 8. I keep my appointments."
Good heavens, what a place to find yourself and what an outcome. Anyway, thank you very much, Shane. And now we'll take a short break.